Good afternoon, you're very welcome to Saturday with Claire Byrne. On today's programme, it's the weekend after the week that rocked the coalition. We hear from Minister Francis Fitzgerald on an extraordinary week in Irish politics. We'll also get the legal ramifications of this week's developments. And also today, the utterly changed relationship between Ireland and England from the Old Bailey to Buckingham Palace. We assess the warm welcome to be afforded to the Irish President next month. First though, it's time for the news with Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon. The emergency services in County Sligo and Tipperary have been dealing with deaths in a fire and in a road accident. A woman died in a house fire in Sligo town, and a married couple died in a car crash in North County Tipperary. Jackie Fox reports.
The woman who died in the house fire in Sligo town was 34. The fire broke out in an upstairs area of a house at White Strand View, Aylesbury Park, shortly before 9:30 last night. Her sons, who were 18 years and 3 years old, were rescued from the house and were uninjured. A local councillor, David Cawley, described the mood of the community.
The community is in shock at the moment. The house itself is only situated at the borough boundary, very close to town, with a tight-knit community. And I feel all that we can do as a community is give our heartfelt sympathies to the family and to support the family in any way we can.
A couple in their 60s died in a crash involving two cars on the N52 between Nina and Borrisicane in North County Tipperary shortly before 5:30 yesterday evening. The couple's son, who's in his 20s, was a passenger in the car. He was seriously injured and has been admitted to hospital. A woman in her 30s who was driving the other car was not injured.
The Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has questioned whether or not the Attorney General Moira Whelan believed that her phone was tapped. Speaking at a launch of Sinn Féin candidates for the forthcoming local elections, Mr. Adams said the country was now faced with an extraordinary and unprecedented situation whereby the Attorney General wasn't willing to discuss issues on the phone with the Taoiseach Enda Kenny. The reluctance of the Attorney General to speak about certain matters on the phone to the Taoiseach was confirmed by Mr. Kenny in the Dáil during the week. Mr. Adams said the Attorney General clearly felt that her phone may have been tapped. A Chinese plane has spotted more objects in the sea as the search for the missing Malaysian airliner gathers pace in a new search area. Two Chinese ships are investigating aerial sightings of debris in a part of the Indian Ocean which was identified by Australian officials yesterday. A magnitude 5.1 earthquake has shaken parts of Los Angeles. The quake was centred on the suburb of La Habra. Emergency services reported gas and water leaks and power cuts in some areas. Los Angeles residents said they'd felt a lot of aftershocks.
We're going to go sleep in the car, going to go away because it just keeps happening. They got all scared and they want to leave. They were freaking out, yelling.
It felt like rocks were hitting the ground and like everything was shaking and we all went under the table and everything. It was pretty freaky.
When I felt it, I felt like the world was going to end and I was going to die.
And the weather forecast. It'll be generally cloudy and misty today. Heavy thundery showers will move into the east of the country. These showers will spread westwards during the day, with spot flooding likely later today, especially in parts of Munster and Connacht. Highest temperatures will be around 11 degrees. That's all for the moment. Back now to Claire.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. We'd like to hear your views on any of the topics we're about to cover over the next hour. You can get in touch by text 51551. The email address is saturday@rte.ie. On Twitter, we're @SaturdayRTE. Joining us today in the studio, we have Minister for Children, Francis Fitzgerald. We're hoping that Sinn Féin's Piers Naughty will be in our Donegal studio very shortly. And we'll also hear from Michael Clifford, Special Correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and TJ McIntyre, Lecturer in Law at UCD and Chair of Digital Rights in Ireland. Now, first today, what a week it has been. The resignation of the Garda Commissioner, the news that numerous Garda stations had been recording calls in and out of stations for years, and the Minister for Justice setting the record straight on the Garda whistleblowers. Let's hear Minister Alan Shatter in the Dáil on Wednesday.
I want to say very clearly that having re-examined the facts and further considered the matter, I believe more should have been done during the course of the Omani investigation to obtain information from and ascertain the views and experiences of the whistleblowers. Further and better efforts could and should have been made to secure productive engagement with them in the investigation of their claims. I therefore wish to correct the record of this House that the whistleblowers, quote, did not cooperate with the Garda investigations that took place. I acknowledge that this statement was incorrect. It was never my intention to mislead the House, and I believe it's appropriate that I apologise to both and withdraw the statements made. It was never my intention to cause any upset, and if any upset was caused, I hope that my correcting the record of the Doyle today will put this matter to rest. In doing so, I again acknowledge, as I have done many times previously, that the reports published and the findings and recommendations that have been made with regard to the fixed notice charge system and penalty points are in response to the allegations made by Sergeant McCabe and supported by former Garda Wilson. I am aware that the whistleblowers and others have issues with some remarks I made outside this House. It was not my intention to misrepresent any matter connected with this issue, and I apologise for any offence that may have been caused by any other remarks made by me.
Minister for Children Frances Fitzgerald is with us, as I said, in studio. At the start of the week on Monday, certainly in public, that's what everybody was expecting and wanted to hear. Were you one of those who wanted Minister Shatter to say what he said? Was it enough for you when he did say it?
Yes, I think when he said it, it was the right thing to do. And I was glad that he had done it. And I think that, as he said himself, having reviewed his original analysis of the Omahony report, that he felt it was right that he should come in and the focus that had been on it. I think it's unfortunate there was so much focus on it in the sense that I think it took away from many of the material changes and the initiatives he had actually taken on a range of the issues which we'll be discussing today. But yes, it was the right thing to do.
Now, before that happened, of course, there was high drama in that the Garda Commissioner, first of all, resigned. I mean, how did you respond to that news when you heard it?
Well, obviously, that was combined with the news in relation to the taping in Garda stations and the tapes and the information that the Taoiseach brought to the Cabinet.
Was Cabinet so, when you first heard about the taping?
Yes, it was. And it was the first time that obviously that everyone heard about it except the Minister for Justice and the Taoiseach and the Attorney General. So the Taoiseach brought that information to Cabinet on Tuesday. And then obviously there was a discussion and you saw the statement that came out saying that there should be a commission of investigation, that this was a very, very significant matter, a deeply serious issue, and that the best way to deal with it at this point was to have a commission of inquiry. And we also made the announcement in that statement that there would be a very significant change, that there would be an independent Garda authority, and another change that the next commissioner of the Gardaí, it would be by way of public competition. That's for the first time that would happen as well.
Why do you think the commissioner left when he did?
Well, I can just go by what he said, which was in the best interests of An Garda Síochána and my family, I have decided to retire. And that he felt that the recent developments were proving to be a distraction for him. And he made that decision himself.
But we have more information on top of that statement. We know that the Secretary General of the Department of Justice paid him a visit. Was that right and proper, do you think?
Well, the Taoiseach, when he was given the information about this issue, decided on that he had to take it very seriously, that it was right and proper as Taoiseach, that he would get as much information as he could on the Monday about it. And part of his decision-making was to ask the Secretary-General of the Department to speak to the Garda Commissioner to let him know how seriously he viewed the situation. So I think that was...
You think it was the right course of action. And do you think that people are right to ask questions about whether he went or he was pushed?
Well, I suppose that's inevitable when there's a resignation, that people speculate about it. And at the end of the day, it's an individual decision based on an assessment of a range of factors, which clearly the Garda Commissioner made. Now, obviously, the context was one of a lot of focus on the remarks he had made himself over previous months, and also the fact that this new information, I mean, these were the context. It was a, as you said, it was a very dramatic week. It was a dramatic context in many ways, and he made that decision. Mm. Inevitably, there would be speculation, but as the Taoiseach said, it was the Garda Commissioner's decision at the end of the day.
But we know now that the Garda Commissioner was doing plenty about the taping issue, and had been for a number of months. So where was he at fault with regard to the taping?
Well, I don't think it's a question of saying that he was at fault in relation to one particular issue. I don't think that is the point in relation to the resignation. He made the decision himself. I think that's really important. What he had or hadn't done in relation to the taping is, I'm sure, will emerge in more detail as the Commission of Investigation gets underway.
Well, we know he'd set up a working group. We know he told the Attorney General. We know that he had ordered that the taping stop in November 2013. We know that he had informed the Minister for Justice, even though the Minister for Justice said he didn't get that information. What more could he have done? The Secretary General is sent around to his department to tell him that there will be a problem at Cabinet with him getting full support of Cabinet, sent by the Taoiseach. He had no option, surely.
Well, I think you're speculating there in relation to the precise discussion that was held. I mean, what's...
The Taoiseach sent the Secretary General
to
speak to him.
Yes, he did. To outline the seriousness of the situation. And subsequent events proved how very serious the situation was, in that the Cabinet decided that a commission of investigation was necessary based on the Taoiseach's briefing to the Cabinet of the scale of the information which had been made available to him the previous day, let us just remember, the previous Sunday evening and the previous Monday, just one day.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the Minister for Justice should really have known about all of this much sooner. We know that because we know that the letter was sent to the Department of Justice for the Minister's attention and he didn't get it. Now, Nora Owen, speaking yesterday to Sean O'Rourke, said if she was Minister Shatter, she'd be really annoyed about that. Would you be if it were you?
Yes, I think it is surprising that he didn't get that letter on the 10th of March. And... obviously, there aren't perfect systems, and clearly that it was an important letter, and I think it is surprising. And I'm sure the minister himself was not satisfied, obviously, that he did not get that letter. But one also has to say that the officials were clearly working on the contents of that letter, in terms of much of it focused, I understand, around the individual case. So it's not as if, you know, no action was taken in relation to it, and I'm sure... undoubtedly, they intended to brief the minister on the actions that were being taken.
We're told in that statement from government on Tuesday that the very security of the state is at risk. Nobody told the minister. It just seems unfathomable that, you know, you say they were working on it, they were taking it seriously, but they don't tell the minister.
In relation to a particular case, I'm sure.
But they don't tell the minister about it.
Well, I can't give you an explanation for that, but I can only say to you that clearly that was an important letter, and one would have expected that the minister would have seen it. I'm sure he would have expected that himself. There aren't perfect systems, human error.
Leo Varadkar said he was finding it hard to get his head around all of it. Are you? Because it seems as though, you know, we knew that the taping was going on. The DPP knew about it because a case was before the courts in 2011 where the taping was an issue. The Attorney General knew about it in November 2013. It was only when one particular case raised its head that there's an issue. Taping conversations is okay, it would seem. It's only when it causes a problem that we have an issue with it.
Well... It is complex what's happened, let's say, over the course of the last year in relation to a whole range of issues. And it's very easy, and I'm sure the public it's very easy for anyone to lose sight of the sequencing of events and what has actually happened to deal with the various issues. And I would like to go into that in some detail, if you'll give me a moment. But in terms of the taping and it being known, I think... yes and no is the answer to that, and let me explain that. If you read the report of June from last year from the
Ombudsman,
you do note that they make a reference to it, but it's in a very general sort of way. It doesn't say that this is a systemic issue that needs to be addressed. It makes a recommendation to the Garda Commissioner at the time to examine that, and I could find the phrase and give it to you in relation to that. You say the Attorney General in November. The Attorney General in November, the scale of the situation as regards taping was not clear in November. It was not clear in November. It was clear when the Attorney General began to become clearer, when the Attorney General briefed the Taoiseach. That's when. I mean, the Attorney General is under an absolute obligation when she has credible evidence, and only when she has credible evidence, to then inform the Taoiseach. That's what she did when she had that information. I have absolutely no doubt about that.
The Director of Public Prosecutions, though, tried in 2011 to introduce evidence of taping as part of the prosecution. So the DPP's office was obviously aware about it and saw no problem with it because tried to use it in evidence in that particular case in Waterford.
Yes, but I can take you back to the Morris report, which I have here in front of me, and you see what the Morris report says. The Morris report makes a recommendation that a review of arrangements for the storage and retrieval of telephone data should be examined. So you're right when you say that particular parts of the system knew various things about taping and it emerged in a variety of ways. But from this government's point of view, it was when the Attorney General briefed the Taoiseach, when the scale of the taping was becoming far more apparent than ever before, that the government then decided to take the action which I've outlined.
Is there more to this story that you know, that we're not allowed to know for legal reasons, that would help people understand where we're at?
Well, there's... That's a difficult question to answer. I don't have any information that I'm withholding in terms of what we've been discussing.
Was there more said at Cabinet about particular individual cases that has been released to the
public?
I was
just going to make that point. Of course, when it comes to individual legal cases, of course, there's always constraints on the material that can be shared. And obviously, there are a range of court cases ongoing at present, so one has to be very cautious, as Minister Shatter said in the Dáil during the week about interfering with court processes, of course, from that point of view. But certainly in terms of both the Taoiseach and Minister Shatter and the reports that they have given in terms of the timelines, they are telling the truth. That is the truth of the situation regarding that letter. There's no conspiracy to hide anything in relation to that letter. And when it came, it, as you say, from a public point of view, why wasn't that letter? It does seem, as you said, difficult to understand. But Alan Shatter went into the Dáil on each of the occasions in relation to GSOC, the bugging and the various issues that have risen in the last year. And particularly, obviously, in relation to this issue, and told the truth about the sequencing of events and took action. And I said I would like to talk about some of the action that has been taken. It is striking that when you go back and examine the actions that have been taken by government and by the Minister for Justice, that you see, for example, in relation to the penalty points issue, that the two reports, the Internal Garda report and the O'Mahony report as well, they were referred to the Garda Inspectorate. And what you see now is a very striking and strong report from the Garda Inspectorate, which when you read it, makes absolutely clear that the system needed fixing and in fact was costing more than it should have, was inefficient, and that there's a series of 36 recommendations which have now been accepted by government in order to fix that system. So it was the Minister for Justice in May 2013 who referred both of those reports to the Garda Inspectorate, who have now come out just a couple of weeks ago.
And vindicated the whistleblowers and prompted that apology from Alan Shatter.
Yes, they have. And I hope the whistleblowers take satisfaction from that, that in fact you now have a series of recommendations, including a setting up of a joint committee between Transport and Justice to oversee the implementation of this report. And it's a very striking report. I have to say, when I read it, it is quite, when you see what is said about the dysfunction in relation to the way this was operated. And of course...
Well, it basically said that if you knew who to talk to, you could get off your penalty points
and
your fines and so on.
What it actually says was that there were serious deficiencies. It was technically deficient, managerially uncoordinated, inefficient and excessively resourced support system.
We've also got the Garda Authority coming down the tracks as well.
Yes.
And there's a suggestion that perhaps the Garda Commissioner should be appointed from outside the Garda Síochána.
Yes.
What do you think of that suggestion?
Well, I think it should be an open competition, and the best person should be appointed, whether they're, you know, from outside the Garda or inside, but an open competition with credibility. But let me just make a final point about these issues. Many of these issues have been around for a long time. I think it's important that action is taken now and that confidence comes back in the public. And it's also important for the Gardaí themselves. I think a new authority will actually be a resource for Gardaí and will give a confidence to Gardaí, because what is happening has probably been extremely undermining for many of the rank and file Gardaí out there.
OK, let's go to Piers Doherty now, who is in our Donegal studio. Piers, you've been listening to the Minister. So once the storm has passed, we have all of these solutions in place. Is that enough in your view?
No, I think we need to find out actually what happened here. The minister talks about the timeline that the minister has put into the public domain last Wednesday, but there's huge questions that arise from that. And, you know, we're either led to believe that the Minister for Justice was completely in the dark of all of this here, that the Commissioner was wrong not to bring it to his attention, that the Attorney General, when she knew of in November, should have brought it to his attention, that the Secretary General in the Department, when he received the letter on the 10th, should have brought it to his attention, that the officials who met with the Commissioner and with the Attorney General's office on the 11th should have brought it to his attention. But nobody done anything, and all of these are really to blame. GSOC, they didn't actually bring the report, the Waterford report, to his attention. They issued a press release. So everybody's to blame, bar Alan Shatter. And I think there is a point when we need to ask, you know, who is accountable, who is responsible for the entire department, and are we going to continue to point fingers at those in the, within the civil service, and maybe fingers are rightly pointed at them, that they should have done their job more efficiently. But there has to be accountability here, and it's clear that no matter what way you look at this here, the Minister for Justice should have known about this issue prior to Monday last.
He didn't, Pearce, but he has the full support not just of his Fine Gael colleagues but also of his Labour colleagues.
Well, he's telling us that he didn't, and he has that confidence from the Taoiseach right down. But sure, he had the confidence of the Taoiseach and Francis Fitzgerald and others, for not issuing an apology until Wednesday, when he had to issue the apology, when really his own job was on the line and he had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the Dáil Chamber to issue that very belated apology. But there are serious questions for the Minister. There are serious questions for the Attorney General. There's serious questions for the administration of justice, and you know, the judgment of certain people within this this saga. And we're only, I believe, at the tip of the iceberg. The fact is that we know that it is a legal case that brought these tapes to light in November, at least into the public domain. We know that that case, we understand that the contents on those tapes will be explosive when they're revealed. I'm sure that the Cabinet are aware of the contents of them. The Attorney General is a member of government. She was aware of this in November of last year, but yet didn't decide to bring this to the attention.
Because we're told she didn't know the extent of the problem or how serious it was at that time. It wasn't until a particular case was raised.
But forget about the fact that there's 2,485 of these tapes, the old style tapes, and we don't know the quantity of the digital tapes. What was brought to her attention is in November that in relation to the case that is before the courts, that there were recordings found at that time in relation to that case. Now, I understand that the contents of that those tapes will be explosive when they are revealed to the public, and that they will have an issue of serious importance to the administration of justice. And it is because of that case that the government decided to act on this matter. But there is questions why the Attorney General only brought this matter to the Taoiseach on Sunday evening and didn't directly bring it to the Taoiseach. It was in the matter in the course of a conversation that was taking place, and she raised this matter and wasn't confident enough to speak on the phone herself, which raises other questions. Does the Attorney General believe that her phone is being listened to or being tapped or being bugged?
Right, and that's something that Gerry Adams said today, taking it to a whole other level. Can I ask you about the motion of no confidence, which is coming from Fianna Fáil and the Minister next week? Will Sinn Féin support that motion of no confidence, Pearse Doherty?
Yes, we've tabled a motion of no confidence in Alan Shatter last year. It's not just about the new revelations. We believe that Alan Shatter isn't fit to hold office in the Department of Justice. I think these new revelations now have compounded that fact, and it's difficult to see how Minister Alan Shatter could actually preside over the type of changes that are expected to take place within the Department of Justice, given that his own officials, you know, didn't bring information, really important information, to his attention, that the commissioner has resigned, that his own friend, his own political donor, has been forced to resign from the position of a confidential recipient, that he has made, you know, terrible claims and accusations on the Dáil record, which he refused to withdraw for months upon months. So there are serious questions as to how he can expect and how the Taoiseach can expect to have him in charge of the Department of Justice. So we will support. It may act as counterproductive, because we can imagine that minister after minister and backbencher after backbencher will proclaim support for the minister, but I think this story will continue to unravel.
I just wonder, from a political point of view, from a strategic point of view, is it coming a little too soon? Because we still have these reports due to come back to us on the GSOC bugging, on the dossier provided by one of the whistleblowers, and so on. I mean, would it not be better to wait until we have all of those reports before we table this motion of no confidence in the minister?
Well, I think what is in the public domain is enough to lend that the public opinion that they have no confidence in Alan Shatter, and the political establishment, particularly in the opposition, are very clear in that point of view. I think the reports will give us further information. But
at that stage, the motion of no confidence will have been debated, and there won't be there's not allowed to be another one for another 6 months, right?
No, but what you're going to see, and you know, it's not the political parties that have heaped the pressure on Alan Shatter. It's Alan Shatter himself. It's his incompetence in terms of the Department of Justice and how he has dealt with issues. Some of the issues that weren't in his control, but how he actually dealt with the issues has heaped huge pressure on Alan Shatter. And I think we will continue to see that. We will continue to see more information coming forward. We now have the information in terms of a member of the judiciary has been drawn into this issue, and I've personally seen the letters and the accusations that have been made against that member. And these are serious issues that the minister has been aware of for a number of weeks. And I can imagine that more issues like that will come to the fore, and there will be serious questions over how Alan Shatter has dealt with them.
I think you're referring to a report that was in the Irish Independent about a judge who had contact with John Wilson, former Garda John Wilson. Is that the story you're referring to?
Yes, I am. Okay. And obviously then there's further issues that the meeting was alleged to have taken place with a member of the Oireachtas, and there's questions in terms of separation of powers and all of the rest, and the claims are being disputed, so it'll be up to the DPP to look into those matters. But okay. I think that this is a trend that you're going to see more issues that are going to come to light. But even forgetting about all of that, the issues that is before us at this point in time is far bigger than the political sphere. This is a legal nightmare for the state, where we have cases that could be overturned, that people who have been convicted could have their convictions
squashed.
Okay,
and we're going to talk about that in detail with our legal expert in just a moment. But I want to put some of the points that you made to Minister Fitzgerald. I think one of the really pertinent points that Pearce makes is that Alan Shatter is not the right man to stand over the changes that you say are so important, the changes that we know will be happening now in the running of the Gardaí. He's just not the man to do it.
I don't agree with that. I believe that Pearce is wrong in saying that. Everyone who knows Alan Shatter knows his record. We know he's the most reforming Minister for Justice that there has ever been in this country. You look at the record, and people know that record and remember that record in terms of the legislation since he's become Minister for Justice.
He's given you so much trouble, though.
He's a reforming minister. He's committed. He has a very deep history and record in terms of a commitment to justice and equality. And that has been his defining characteristic as a lawyer and as a politician.
What about the stubbornness? What about the refusal to back down? Are they not defining characteristics?
Well, you know, I don't think this is about personality, and there's been a lot of focus on personalities in this. This is about the goals and the outcomes that you want to see.
But it was the delay with the apology, which is all about personality, that captured so many headlines for so long.
I understand that captured headlines. But as I said, let's look at what has actually happened and what is going to happen as a result of the decisions that both Alan Shatter and this government have taken. The potential for change in those initiatives which have been undertaken, including, if you look at the terms of reference again of the Cook and the Guerin report, you see that in those terms of reference, where the one that is examining the variety of cases that Sergeant McKay brought for the dossier, you look at the terms of reference in that, about the relationship between the Gardaí, about the material and the evidence that's in the department, they are very wide ranging. If you look at the decisions from last Tuesday's cabinet meeting. This is wide-ranging reform of what has been, and let's be clear, of certain elements of a systemic culture that has not been good enough in the Gardaí.
Okay.
That's what we're now addressing, and that is what is important. And it's this minister, if you look at again at what the action he took last May, if you look at the range of government decisions, no other government has taken this wide-ranging approach, even though, as we've discussed earlier, many of these elements have been round and about
Pearce,
the system.
Pearce, quick word before we take a break.
The culture that Francis Francis talks about there in terms of the Gardaí, and she's right to point that out. But that culture stemmed right to the Minister for Justice. So when the penalty point whistleblowers came forward, the Minister for Justice dismissed them. When the first report for the Mahony report came out, he went on the plinth and took pleasure in dismissing their claims as ridiculous.
That's not true. Why do we have a Gardaí inspectorate report? We have a Gardaí inspectorate report because the penalty points issue was referred by him to the Gardaí inspectorate report, which is now recommending the most far-reaching change that has ever been recommended in relation to this issue.
Francis, he made the comments and the comments stand on the public record. He then went into the Dáil and made comments that were incorrect against the whistleblowers. He went on RTÉ and made incorrect reference to the whistleblowers. When the issue in terms of the bugging of GSOC came forward, he dismissed it as absolute nonsense. At the same time, he was willing to use tittle-tattle from the Commissioner in terms of Deputy Mick Wallace. He has been condescending in the way he has dealt with the policing element of his department. I don't question his commitment to other areas within his department, but unfortunately in the issue in terms of policing, he has been a complete and utter failure, and we can see that by the heads that have rolled. The confidential recipient's head has rolled, the commissioner's role has rolled. There are serious questions now about the judgment of the Attorney General and why she didn't see the significance of this when it was brought to her attention.
All right, Pierce, you're going over old ground there.
At everybody in his department.
I've got to take a break now. Pierce Doherty and Francis Fitzgerald there. We're going to be coming back to Michael Clifford and TJ McIntyre after this quick break. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. We have Minister for Children and Youth Affairs Francis Fitzgerald. Pierce Doherty, Sinn Féin TD, is in Donegal. We have Michael Clifford, who is a special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Michael, as in from very, very recent appointment, congratulations to you. And TJ McIntyre, lecturer in law at UCD and chair of Digital Rights Ireland. Now, Michael, we're going to go to you on your front page story today. You say that a lot of these Garda recordings have been erased. This is pre-2008, right?
Pre-2008, yeah. There's a system in place. They used it. It was described as a guardian box, just technically that was the system, which used physical tapes and then had a system of rotation used therein, which would mean, for example, in the busier stations, you might have a tape that lasts only a week or perhaps 2 weeks. That would be taken out and another one put in. They'd have a number of tapes there and you'd come back to that in a few months.
Okay, using so you're taping system, over.
Taping over, effectively, like the old, those of us who remember taping music and taping over, what have you. That's exactly what it was. Now, except in instances where, for example, you'd have had an emergency call that would subsequently be used in a court proceeding or whatever, that would be held. It might end up in the DPP's office, and I'm not sure where that would end up. Sometimes that might have been sent back or not. So a lot of the material, huge amounts of material, are simply gone. It is possible in some instances to retrieve stuff that has been taped over, but as I understand it, it's pretty difficult, and that depends on how many times it has been taped
over. But post 2008, when the digital system was put in place, that wouldn't be the case. So a lot of those would still exist.
Absolutely. But this has been, people have been speaking in terms of this going back 30 years. It would seem that in all of the cases pre-08, not all of the cases, but that a lot of the material pre-08 is just not accessible in terms of the actual material. The fact of whether stuff was recorded or not is a separate issue, but accessing the actual material, I think, is going to be a very difficult process.
So are you saying this might not be as big a deal as it was originally supposed to be?
Well, to this extent, certainly instances were raised, if you look, and again, this is only pre-08, for example, an instance whereby a witness may have rang in to the station with an account of something that happened, gave a subsequent statement, and that statement was tested in court. Now, the defence in that instance would not have had access to the original phone call and test whether there were differences between that and the written statement that the witness may have given. There was people suggesting that, you know, therefore, if that was available, this could open up cases again. Quite obviously, if the material isn't there, then that's gone. Now, in instances where there, and TJ know a lot more about this than me, but in instances where you've this business of people who are prisoners who are detained phoning their solicitor for legal advice, the material again would not be available. How we might trace whether or not it's been listened into. The fact that it was recorded is a separate issue altogether. Some legal people are saying that is the issue and that's what's going to open the Pandora's box. Others that I've been speaking to are not so sure about that at all.
Okay. TJ, can you shed some light on this? If you make a call from a Garda station, do you have a right to that call being private, or can you expect that somebody would listen to it? I mean, what are the rules around that? What are the legalities around that?
Well, in fact, there are very few rules around it in one sense, which is why we're having this conversation today. Now, the basic law is quite clear. Interception of communications on a public telephone network is a criminal offence unless it's carried out with the consent of one of the parties to the conversation. And interception here means a number of things. It means the actual listening into the conversation. It includes the recording of the conversation. And it even includes making use of the contents of the conversation at a later stage. All of those are distinct offences. Now, in addition to that, you have data protection obligations, which require that if you're collecting data, you tell people you're doing so. So you notify them that calls to the station might be recorded. You keep the data only for a particular purpose, maybe for criminal prosecutions, and you keep it only for a limited period, whatever is necessary for that purpose. And it's quite clear that the system as we have it so far didn't meet any of those standards.
Okay, so Michael Clifford has just said that this mightn't be as big as perhaps we thought it was because the tapes pre-2008 were perhaps recorded over. Do you agree that that might be the case?
I don't know if that's going to be the case or not. Now, granted, we don't really know a lot here. We know that the recording took place, but we don't know who might have accessed those tapes, when they might have done so and for what purpose.
But if you're a lawyer in a case and you're saying my client was sent to prison on these grounds and we don't know if somebody recorded their conversation and then we don't know if somebody listened to the conversation, will the onus be on you to prove that that conversation was listened to, quite apart from being recorded?
That's a very good question. And the short answer is we don't know yet. This is unprecedented, where we'd have a violation of constitutional rights in terms of listening to solicitor-client recordings, which this clearly is. And the question then becomes, does that invalidate anything else that might have taken place during the course of that detention? For example, does it mean that a continued detention after that fact, after somebody's advice call was listened to, then becomes illegal? We simply don't know that as of yet. But in addition, I'd just like to make the point that there's a very significant issue here, not just for the solicitor-client side of things, but also for the disclosure of evidence to the defence. And Mick picked up on that when he said that you might have a case where, let's say, a witness rang in, said something on the phone to Gardaí, later they made a formal statement, there might be discrepancy between the two, and the defence say, well, we should have had the chance to cross-examine that witness on that discrepancy. So the defence in that case would be saying, you should have disclosed to us the fact that you had a recording of what a witness said or a victim said on the phone, or perhaps a guard phoned in on his personal mobile phone, perhaps there was a conversation about a case there. In each of those cases, if you had a tape which contained relevant information relating to a criminal prosecution, it's clear that disclosure should have been made.
The other issue there, though, TJ, is like, from what I can gather, very often, very few people actually knew this system was in place. And the issue then is, should they have known, or is the fact that they didn't know, is that defence enough in saying they didn't discover this because they didn't know that? Is that enough of a defence, I wonder?
That is a problem. And to be fair, so far what we see here, I think it's mostly shambolic rather than sinister. It was a system that was public in a certain way. It was public to the extent that the 2007 tender was public. It was public in the sense that certainly individual guards knew about it. We've heard from the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors that some telephones had stickers on them telling you the calls might be taped, though they
still do, yeah.
The Garda Representative Association has disputed that. It's not necessarily the case that this was being done in an underhand manner. But I think what is very important is that, notwithstanding that, the duty of disclosure on the prosecution in a criminal trial is one of the strongest duties that there is. In fact, it doesn't even extend just to material the prosecution itself has. It extends to material they should have sought out from third parties. Mm-hmm. I don't think any court would be prepared to accept the argument that, well, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
And what's your view on the DPP trying to use this, trying to admit this as evidence in that 2011 case in Waterford?
Well, I think the DPP acted properly in seeking to admit it as evidence. It wasn't a matter ultimately for the DPP to decide on admissibility. That was a matter for the court. I'm a little bit more concerned about the fact that the DPP in November 2011, when that case concluded, didn't seem to appreciate the significance of the wider point and didn't seem to flag it with Garda management or with the Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. As far as we know, certainly, it appears as though there should have been recognition of the issue in November 2011. And of course, it was only 2 years later that the recordings were ultimately stopped.
Yes. And at that time, in November 2013, the Attorney General was made aware of it, we know. But we're told that she didn't think it was significant enough to inform the minister until the last week or so, or the Taoiseach rather, in the last week.
It may be that there is a particular case that prompted awareness of why that is. I simply don't know.
I know, but the point is that are we saying, is the DPP saying, is the Attorney General saying that recording of telephone conversations is fine until we get in trouble?
But there was some recording anyway.
There is legitimate recording, of course, and that is the issue.
That if there was no recording in Garda stations, you can see that this would have raised red flags immediately. But there was some recording. The other issue is whether or not the reaction from the government effectively bigged this up for political reasons. And remember, there was a working group in place, and the most obvious thing of all is, why was that working group not allowed to complete what it was doing? OK, as particular case came into focus, and we all know what case that was, the Bailey case, but the actual material, the transcript, so to speak, of that, we're told, was the big thing that raised red flags. That's totally irrelevant. It's the potential for the calls to be made, the recording of them. The actual material that was involved in that case is totally irrelevant to the whole system. It's highly relevant to that specific case, but I don't think it's relevant to the whole system.
On Thursday morning in The Examiner, you wrote this. Was the Garda Commissioner sacked to save Alan Shatter's bacon?
Yeah, and I personally believe he probably was. I mean, the whole idea of in the first instance, you send out Secretary General of the Department of Justice to explain how seriously this is taken. Well, I think everybody would have been perfectly aware of how serious it was. Why didn't the Minister for Justice go out? I mean,
well, he didn't know about it at that stage, did he?
Well, he knew it was Monday evening. He was in a meeting with the Taoiseach and the two Secretary Generals of their respective departments. This is not The Apprentice, you're fired. Enda Kenny does not point at the commissioner and tell him he's fired. These things are done with great subtlety. When it's explained to a commissioner, as the accounts were told, point towards that he apparently did not have the confidence of some of the cabinet, as was told, even though we find out that most of the cabinet didn't even know about it. But this is the commissioner's version we've heard via sources close to him and Paul Reynolds or whatever. But when that is put to him, it's quite obvious, to use that phrase, which I think some people may find offending, is this phrase of somebody being handed the revolver and a bottle of whiskey, and it's either you take the decision to jump before you're pushed. And this was reinforced when he phoned the following morning, and I think the phrase that was used is he was told the situation had not improved. Remember, on Sunday night, the government had a growing problem. It was growing even on Sunday. I think it was Sunday Eamon Gilmore dragged Mr. Shatter into it. Up until then, it had only been the commissioner. They had a growing problem. By Tuesday afternoon, that problem had been solved. Unbelievable speed had been used to set up a commission of inquiry, where in other instances, like for example Sergeant McCabe's allegations, we used to go through a process before you even get to a commission of inquiry. Everything was sorted politically by Tuesday afternoon.
So we can deduct from what you're saying that you believe Martin Callanan's departure had nothing to do with the taping, because because he was dealing with that.
Oh, I think to be honest with you, I'd be highly critical of Martin Callanan's role in the whistleblower thing. Highly critical. In terms of the taping, I think he was completely wronged, if that's exactly why he was fired. And let's face it, I understand what the minister's saying, but I find it very difficult to accept there's any other reading from it other than he was fired to the extent that the situation was explained to him in terms that suggested it would be very difficult for him to carry on. If you want to put it that way, other people will just say that's a simple way of saying he was fired. The mere presence of the Secretary General on his doorstep, rather than anything he may have said specifically to him, tells its own story.
Minister, well, do you want to respond?
I responded to that earlier, but I mean, I think the earlier discussion here, when we were discussing the impact of the tapes, the potential impact on individual cases, all of the points, the legal points that were raised, absolutely show why the Taoiseach acted as he did. I mean, Mick talks about speed and why there was so much speed. There was so much speed because of the seriousness of the issue. That's why the Taoiseach acted as he did.
But if that's the case, Minister, then what preceded it can only be described as gross incompetence and dysfunction at all levels, because the number of times it should have been flagged. If suddenly if the Taoiseach sees it and it suddenly becomes an absolute potential for a scandal, yet GSOC, the AG officials, the Department of Justice officials, the meetings between the Gardaí and all...
What you're missing out there, Mick, in that sort of litany you've gone through, which we discussed earlier, how it was in the system, but the scale and the seriousness hadn't been acted upon. What you're missing out on there is the briefing that the Taoiseach got, the information that was arising primarily through one case, and then the further, if you like, validation of that, or verification, I should say, that the Taoiseach conducted on the course of the Monday. And let me just go back to the GSOC report. I mean, you say it was in the system. What did the GSOC report conclude in June 2013? What they said, on consideration of the ruling of the court, the Garda Commissioner may wish to re-evaluate his practice regarding the recording of such calls and the consents required if it is to be permissible to use such recordings in evidence.
So then, so let's blame GSOC.
I'm not blaming them. No, no, I am not blaming them, but I'm just making the point about how it was in the system. And it's one thing, and we all know, I know it from my own background in the social policy area, that until you start putting the different pieces together, things crystallise at a certain point. They crystallised on Monday for the Taoiseach and the Attorney General, who is duty bound when she has the evidence, and only when she has the evidence, to speak to the Taoiseach. And that's when the decision was taken that a commission of investigation is needed.
Cold eye of the law across all of this, and what Mick says about, you know, why it came up at the time that it came up, and you've heard Francis Fitzgerald reasoning as well. What's your view?
Well, I have to feel a certain degree of sympathy for the Commissioner in this regard, in that I would agree with Mick in that he appears to have acted properly once the matter was brought to his attention. But it seems to me very worrying that in 2011 in particular, when the issue became concrete in the context of the Waterford prosecution, that it wasn't dealt with at that stage. And in fact, it's striking that the Data Protection Commissioner's office didn't even identify the existence of this issue when it was carrying out an audit of the Gardaí, an audit report which was issued publicly just last week. Mm-hmm.
Well, he said that it wasn't best practice, that they were seeking retrospective permission for dealing with telecommunications issues. It is, in fact, legal what the Gardaí were doing, seeking retrospective permissions.
I mean, there's a simple thing too. I mean, on the most basic level, we know, for instance, the minister and the commissioner had a close working relationship. We know that they interacted in unusual stuff, like Mick Wallace's tittle tattle, is what effectively was that stuff. How come, even since November until last weekend, there wasn't even a text between the commissioner and the minister? You know. This
You're suggesting now that the minister knew all along about
the
tape.
No, I'm not necessarily saying that. But what I'm saying is, if it was as serious as has been deemed by the government that they immediately set up a commission of inquiry,
then the minister would have known.
Yes, if that's the level of serious. So either it is not that serious, or there was complete dysfunction preceding it.
Piers Doherty, is it not that serious?
Well, first of all, let's be clear, outside of the impact it will have on the cases, which I think is going to be the most serious element if that transpires, is that the recordings that were carried out are illegal, that it was an offence under the Act. So whoever sanctioned those recordings has committed an act under a piece of legislation in 1983.
But my question for you is, do you believe that the government was right to treat this with the seriousness that it did at the start of this week?
The government was right to treat it with the seriousness at the time that it should have been brought to their attention. And this is where I find it hard to believe that this all crystallised on Sunday evening. And that's what we're being asked to believe by Francis Fitzgerald here. The Attorney General is a member of the government. In November, she was told, in a quote, of the possible existence of other tapes along with the existence of the tapes in relation to the Ian Bailey case. That was in November. We had a letter from the Commissioner on the 10th of March. Members of the Attorney General's office met with the Commissioner in the Minister Shatter's department, along with members of Minister Shatter's officials. They discussed this issue. At that time, they were aware that there was 2,500 or nearly 2,500 of these recordings pre-2008. And this still wasn't brought to the Taoiseach or the Cabinet's attention until a conversation happened that was on an unrelated matter. So there's serious questions here. And it's very just hard to believe the narrative of government. Either there is complete incompetence on a wide range of levels, or something just doesn't stack up in relation to this year. And I think find it very difficult to follow the type of narrative that has been provided by government spokespersons, that this all just materialised on Sunday night. And I think a statement from the Attorney General clarifying just what she knew, when she knew, when she's seen the significance of this for pending cases and the scale of this here, and why she didn't feel it necessary until Sunday evening to bring this to the Taoiseach's attention. And we see the consequences of that when the Commissioner was clearly sacked.
That's not likely to happen, we're told. Kevin from County Dublin has a message for the Labour Party. With the local and European elections on the way, Labour should look for more information in relation to the taping, the resignation and Force Minister Shatter to give more clarity. Otherwise, I think they'll be wiped out at the ballot box, and rightly so. After this break, we'll be discussing the President's visit to Britain. You're listening to Saturday with Clare Byrne. Details were released this week about the visit next month of President Michael D. Higgins to Britain. It'll be the first official visit there by an Irish head of state. And there was some surprise at the prominence the visit has been given by Buckingham Palace. For a start, it's a four-day event, and the President will stay at Windsor Castle, an invitation extended to only the most valued guests of Queen Elizabeth. One of those present at the announcement of the details this week was Sally Mulready, who's a Labour councillor for Hackney in London. We last heard from Sally when she was campaigning for the Magdalen Women, and she was also involved in the campaigns for the release of the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6. You're very welcome, Sally, once again to the programme. Events this week mark a major shift, would you agree, in how the Irish are seen and treated in Britain?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, first of all, can I say it's a good time to be Irish in Britain? It does mark a major shift. The invitation, for example, to Buckingham Palace earlier on this week, I felt it was a gesture of great courtesy by the Queen to the Irish community in Britain.
This was the event that was held on Tuesday?
Yes, at Buckingham Palace, on the run-up to the visit by the President. For me, it was recognition of our contribution as Irish people to British society in every way, in our contribution in education, in the arts, in sport, in business, you name it. It was, you know, we all felt walking into Buckingham Palace that sense of being recognised, and our community and Irish people being recognised. The invitation to the President, you know, to Windsor Castle, what's widely regarded as the Queen's home, is very significant. And we're looking forward to that immensely.
And for you, I mean, I mentioned some of the campaigns that you were involved in. Things were so different just a short time ago.
They were very different. And I mean, you know, walking to the palace again, I, you know, reflected on how far we've come. You know, relations between Ireland and Britain have always been complex. But at this moment in time, there's a feeling that the relations have never been warmer and stronger and for me, more equal. But, you know, the wounds are deep. The Good Friday Agreement makes us kind of realise just how important ongoing and continuous reconciliation is. This is all part of that.
Where is this?
Very special. And the other thing, can I say, I'm absolutely delighted that this is happening under our President, Michael D, and Sabina's presidency. I think it'll bring a certain amount of finesse and creativity to it. Which will be wonderful, not just for Irish people here, but Irish people all over the world.
Where is all this coming from, do you think? The depth of the warmth of the welcoming, is it Queen Elizabeth herself, or is it coming from a grassroots feeling there that things have changed?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be competent to kind of give you the definitive on that, but certainly from just ordinary Irish people like myself, you know, we have felt over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, starting with when Mary Robinson first saw the Queen, and then the visit by the Queen last year, or when was it, 2 years ago, to Ireland as guest of Mary McAleese. It's all kind of built up to
where we're at.
A great historic moment. But for Irish people here, it really is a very, very special occasion.
Okay, Minister Frances Fitzgerald is still with us. Are you going on part of that trip next month?
Yes, on Wednesday afternoon, part of the agenda, it's a very big agenda, a very detailed programme that the President has when he's visiting, but part of the programme is a youth workshop with young people from Ireland and England, north, south, east, west, meeting together to talk about taking charge of change together. And the President has been particularly interested in working with young people. And I think
think it's great that there's a next generation focus on the events. The president will hear the outcome of the workshop. The mayor will be there. And so the young people will tell the president and the mayor what they've been discussing. And then the president will make an address to them. Mm-hmm. So that's very exciting. And it's great to hear Sally saying, I mean, it's a good time to be Irish in Britain. I mean, I lived in London for 6 years in the 70s, and it was very different then when there were threats of bombs and threats. And, you know, to hear Sally saying that we're more strong, more equal, and the visit represents all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very accurate.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I lived in London for a while myself. And I mean, if you go back half a century to things like, you know, portrayals like Tom Murphy's A Whistle in the Dark and the way the Irish were regarded over there, the shock of having to go over there from rural areas here and all, and you see where it's got to now. And for people like that in particular, people who've been over there a long time who felt alienated. I think there was a line there in Kings of the Kilburn High Road, people saying they were neither Irish nor English, they were Paddies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's a whole generation like that over there, and I think it'll be hugely significant for them.
It certainly is, and really I suppose it's happened, you know, if you contextualise it over a short period of time, really, that this change has happened. I mean, Frances, you make reference to the 70s, not that long ago.
Absolutely. I think sometimes, you know, when things are good as well, it's easy to take them for granted. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see this sort of, you know, this serious engagement with the president and the number of events he's attending and the way the visit is being dealt with.
Indeed.
And, you know, relationships can change fairly quickly between countries as well, as we've seen between Russia and America recently. So
Absolutely.
It's important to continue to build on the progress.
OK, thank you very much. Indeed, Sally Mulready, for joining us from London today. Just to let you know, next week and the week after, Brian Dowling from our political staff will be sitting in this seat. I want to say a very special goodbye to our producer Peter Woods, who is leaving us but not RTE. He's heading up in the world to become head of current affairs in radio. We will really miss him from the programme. I want to thank him personally for all his hard work. He's made this show a huge success and convinced nearly 250,000 of you to listen in every Saturday afternoon. So the best of luck to Peter, and thank you very much. Thanks to all my guests today. We'll be back with you at 1 o'clock. Well, Brian will be back with you at 1 o'clock next Saturday. Take care. Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher was Leslie Anderson. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney, and sound supervision today was by Noel Roberts.